The BS Report is presented by Subway. Football season is over. Footlong season is just beginning. For a limited time, get any piled high regular footlong for just $5. Any footlong, just $5. Hurry in, Subway. Eat fresh. Eat fresh. The BS Report is a free-flowing conversation that occasionally touches on mature subjects.
First of all,
this is the BS Report with Bill Simmons.
It might be cool, I don't know. And if it's not, I don't care.
The BS Report with Bill Simmons.
Bill Simmons works for ESPN. He's also named the sports guy, and he writes a comical sports column. You must be a popular dude.
The BS Report.
It's got a real dirty sound, like a rusty steak knife cutting through a well-aged steak.
Now.
Here's Bill Simmons.
All right, it's podcast week here on the BS Report as I am frantically trying to finish my book. Thank you for your patience as the world tries to survive without my columns for at least this week. It's Oscar week, so we had to have our friend Chris Connolly. He's on the Mount Rushmore of podcast guests for us and also working the Oscars. So who better to come on than Chris Connolly? Chris, how you doing?
I am very well, Bill.
Well, America is on pins and needles. We have to know. What are you going to wear on Sunday night?
I think I'll go with a light kind of Azzedine Alaia frock. It's cut very tight across the bodice.
Nice.
Really accentuates my curves. And I'll be wearing a pair of Spanx.
You're not going to wear any Oscar de la Renta?
No, I will be passing on the Oscar de la Renta. Too old school for me.
Do you think that this is, from a buzz standpoint, the Mickey Rourke thing has pushed this Oscars to another level, as well as Brangelina both being nominated?
I think people are very excited about Mickey. I think the idea of any theater in Hollywood holding at one time both Mickey Rourke and Jerry Lewis really sets the needle into the red zone.
Why is Jerry Lewis going to be there?
Jerry Lewis is getting the Gene Herschelt Humanitarian Award. Jerry Lewis is going to be honored with a standing ovation at the Oscars.
Oh, my God. And people are going to be depressed by Jerry Lewis.
People are never depressed by Jerry Lewis. He's not going to sing You'll Never Walk Alone. It'll be a big moment. It's the first time you're able to see Jerry Lewis on live television without Norm Crosby.
Excellent. I'm excited about that.
There you go.
You got Jerry Lewis, Brangelina, Mickey Rourke, Clint Eastwood. Did he get nominated?
Clint did not get nominated.
Not even for director?
I'm not sure if Clint's going to be there or not.
He won't go then. Screw that.
You can always hope, yeah.
We got Sean Penn.
We got Sean Penn. Come on. We got Anne Hathaway. We got Kate Winslet.
Somehow only getting nominated once and not twice, which made no sense.
Well, it made plenty of sense because they were both lead roles. Neither one was a supporting role, and you're not allowed to be nominated in the same category twice if you're an actor.
You really think The Reader was a leading role and not a supporting role?
The Reader was a leading role? Are you kidding? How much do you think she was in The Reader?
Well, but they kind of.
She was in Young. She had love scenes. She was with Ralph Fiennes. She was with David Cross. She did everything but craft services.
Wait, do you think she goes down as the hottest Nazi ever?
Well, I don't know. There was Werner Klemperer.
So, from a general fan interest standpoint, I think the Mickey Rourke, that whole category, ranks right up there with really anything we've had in the Oscars.
It's amazing, isn't it? I mean, there's a little bit of everything going on in that.
It really is. Let's go through. I love this category. So,
sure.
Frank Langella for Frost Nixon.
He was fine.
My favorite performance.
Well, he won a Tony for it, you know, I think, if I'm not mistaken.
Does that hurt his chances or no?
You know, it hurts in a sense because people know he's already been acknowledged for the award. He's not so of the community as some of these other actors are, you know. I think it hurt the movie the way it was perceived just because people thought of it as already a very successful play. And so when you take a very successful play and you put it on screen, people have a, show me how you reinvented it idea. It was already great, that kind of thing.
Does that hurt him more than the fact that he appeared as the Knicks owner in Eddie? With a cowboy hat on, playing a Southern guy?
You are not old enough to remember when Frank Langella was one serious sex symbol for his role as Dracula on Broadway.
What do you mean I'm not old enough to remember? He was in the movie, wasn't he?
Right, you know, but like it was in the theater. It was on stage that Frank was like sizzlingly hot. That's actually what generated a lot of his press back then, you know. He would do I Love New York ads as Dracula, I remember. So,
right.
He's all the rage. So, I don't think he's hurt, and I think his invention of Nixon as kind of a faded matinee idol is really fascinating.
I agree.
But he's not, you know, but he's surrounded by a lot of other interesting performances, I guess is what you'd say.
That was my favorite performance, but I fully expect him not to win.
I think he fully expects not to win, but it'll have a great time. So
Mickey Rourke, amazing, one-of-a-kind performance. He was better than the movie itself, there's no question. I do wonder, though, if you think of all the old farts in the Academy, how many of them are actually going to be down with that?
I don't know that they have to be. I mean, I think there are places for their votes to go otherwise. You know, if you were going to be all Nate Silver about it, you'd have to...
You just used Nate Silver as a verb.
As an
adjective?
As an adjective,
yeah.
then you'd have to say, how much can Mickey get from Sean Penn's traditional constituency? You know, the people you talk about, they have places they can go. They can go to Frank Langella. They can go to the old school performances. But Mickey has got to take enough of Sean to be able to win, you might say. So you're absolutely right. You know, Mickey's been, I like to say that that if Mickey wins the Oscar for this performance, it will be the Academy's first lifetime lack of achievement award.
like giving Vince Carter a lifetime MVP or something.
Just, you know, just for all the years he messed up, for all the opportunities he blew, for all the years that we thought he'd be a superstar, it didn't happen. He's making it up in this thing. If you said 20 years ago, two guys who were talking about in the late 80s will be nominated for Best Actor, one of them will have completely messed up his career over the last 20 years, and the other will be a smooth professional actor who's still seen as kind of a rebel. Who would you have thought was Sean Penn, and who would you have thought was Mickey Rourke?
Interesting.
And now here they are, battling it out.
I gotta say, all of Mickey's problems that he had in the 80s and the early 90s, actually, it made him underrated, but now he might have become overrated because everybody talks about, you know, what a lost career he had and all that. Like, I agree that he was a very good actor, a very good young actor. I do wonder how great really he could have been. Like, where does he go?
The thing that's hard to, you know, it's hard to recapture is how much women loved him. Women just thought he was the thing. Like, if you were covering Hollywood there, he was the one everyone wanted to know. Sean Penn, Tim Hutton, Tom Cruise, they were all popular, but it was Mickey who everybody really got into in a big way. And remember, he was in boys' movies. Like, you know, his appeal made Diner cross over to women, you know?
Right.
And so that's the lost thing, that kind of sizzle, the kind of, where 9.5 weeks sort of became the apotheosis of his career. That's the lost thing, that kind of, that kind of appeal to women that's gone.
Yeah, who else could have played that character in 9.5 weeks, which was a terrible movie, by the way, but very well done, and he was good in it.
Well, what would you say? You would say, like,
Richard Gere, I guess.
Richard Gere, because it's very much like the Richard Gere character in Internal Affairs.
Yep.
You know.
That could have been Mickey Rourke. So basically, Richard Gere's career would have basically been Mickey Rourke's career.
Well, it's funny.
Or they would have fought for roles.
Have you seen American Gigolo recently?
Yeah.
I know it's a tough question to ask anybody.
No, I like American Gigolo.
If you ever watch American Gigolo, you ever notice how big the exercise equipment is? You know why it's so big? It was designed for John Travolta. All the equipment in that movie was designed for John Travolta, and then he dropped out and Gear came in. So it's all, like, not quite Gear size.
Wow. I'm more stunned by the fact that John Travolta was almost American Gigolo.
Well, he was hot off of Moment by Moment, then.
So he could have basically been American Gigolo, Saturday Night Fever guy, and Urban Cowboy, and then Grease guy in like a 4-year span.
We haven't even mentioned the fact they wanted to do Godfather 3 with him at some point.
What year was that?
Early 80s, I think. That might be lost to history.
Huh. Well, yeah, the Gear, I like the parallel thing between Gear and Rourke. I maintain that I get the whole thing with women and Mickey Rourke and all that stuff, but I maintain that the whole mythology now that he was like this great lost actor of that generation, it's a pretty tough thing to say. You know who he reminds me of is Michael Ray Richardson, where Michael Ray Richardson, basically his ceiling was a poor man's Magic Johnson. And he was great, and he resonated with the fans there, and he was immensely fun to watch, all that stuff. But ultimately, how good would Michael Ray Richardson have been?
Well, but
probably
I think
Hall of Famer.
I would say your analogy is accurate in the sense that we loved Michael Ray Richardson for the fact that he had $70,000 worth of work done to a rented apartment. You know, that the seeds of his self-destruction were part of his appeal in the first place. Like, he kind of knew it wasn't going to end well.
Right.
And he also, I think, kind of, once 9.5 weeks kicked in, you kind of knew that was going to happen to Mickey. 9.5 weeks, Angel Heart, you know, going into the Cary Otis thing. You didn't need a roadmap to know where this story was ending.
So maybe the self-destruction was part of the appeal.
I think it made him more romantic. That's
yeah,
right.
The
I think he's cashing that check this year, yeah.
So when he gets up on the stage, potentially, and I really don't think he's going to win. I think Sean Penn is going to win. But if he walks up on the stage to give an Oscar acceptance speech,
yeah.
Where would you put that in the all-time pantheon of, I have no idea what's going to happen right now in the history of the Oscars?
I would say that whoever is doing, the censor better have a real trigger finger on the button.
Yeah.
I heard that he was, you know, I heard that he was saying, like, his agent or his manager, that he owes it all to his agent or manager. And, you know, frankly, I have a feeling Mickey probably owes it all to a couple of guys in Miami Beach you wouldn't want to see in an alley.
That's true.
So I think anything could happen. I think anything could happen.
Well, he's also kind of secretly, quietly, a little bit falling apart. There's been some weird stories floating around about his behavior.
Well, I'm sure they're taking very good care of him. Let's put it that way. It's a lot for a guy who hasn't been out lately to deal with. And the truth is, you'd have to say that there have been no punch outs. There have been no trips to the emergency room. He's done all right. But the pressure of the Oscars, yes, it could snap him like a twig.
And then, I think it was Us Weekly or one of those reputable magazines, but they had a thing about how he tried to make a move on the girl who played the daughter in his movie. And so there was some bitterness, and she was really upset about it after. And then Mickey basically disappeared from the party interview circuit
you don't really know what's going on there. Remember, this is Evan Rachel Wood we're talking about, who dated Marilyn Manson for a while.
Right. If you can offend her, you've done something substantial.
Anything's possible.
So we got Mickey, we got Langella.
Right.
I love both of them. Sean Penn and Milk.
And he was terrific.
He was excellent.
It's just great to see him play a role like that where he's loose and fun and he's smiling. And, you know, you think of think of how close that movie came to getting made over 20 or 30 years and how lucky it was that Sean Penn was ready to take that part because I think he's terrific in it.
Easiest role of the three, though?
Easiest role?
I think
role?
It is. Yeah.
Think of the actor. Think of how dark his characters usually are. Think of how interior he gets. And now he's connecting with everybody. That's the thing that's so exciting. I think he's always been one of our best actors, right? But you could say in the recent movies he was creating characters who were solitudes, who didn't really have relationships, who people kind of bounced off of. You could say that's been happening ever since Casualties of War, maybe. But here in this movie, he's constantly, like, engaging people. He's constantly, like, and that's not a thing we've seen from Sean Penn before, you know, in his performances. It's like, they used to say Garbo laughs, exclamation point, was a selling point of a film back in the 40s or so, and this is Sean smiles. And I think it's great to see him be charming in a movie. We haven't seen that in a good while.
The thing I like the most about the performance is that, you watch movies and people basically play themselves for the most part. Like, you go to Marley and Me, Jennifer Aniston's playing Jennifer Aniston with a dog that's dying. Like, she's not acting. Sean Penn became Milk. Like, within 10 minutes, I forgot it was Sean Penn. I'm just watching the movie and thinking that's Harvey Milk, which I think is the toughest last step to make for any good actor, when you just lose yourself in the character to the point that you become unrecognizable.
Well, and this was his training. I mean, this is what he kind of used to do back in the day, you know, when he was in Fast Times and in movies like that. Now I think he's found a way to do it and still, you know, and not wig himself out in the process, sort of becoming a character, you know.
Yeah, I think, Falcon and the Snowman was like that, too.
Yes, yes, and that there is some similarity in that character. It's funny you mentioned that. That's the closest thing he's played to somebody like this before. But just the easy charm, just the like the you know, I just thought it was a great performance.
I
really enjoyed that movie.
Yeah, and I actually thought he was overrated in Mystic River. He is Sean Penn with a Boston accent. I didn't feel like it was an acting performance on the level of The Guy in Milk.
You know, there's some movies that are really influential in terms of films. You know, like that whole Malibu generation, the Penns, the Esteveses, the Sheens. Their sensibility about Hollywood was really formed by Apocalypse Now, because that was the first movie they heard about getting made when they were kids.
Yeah.
So a lot of what their lives are like afterwards professionally has to do with what happened to Martin Sheen on Apocalypse Now. You know what's a really formative movie that way is Mystic River, because you have all these actors who come from very different backgrounds. Sean Penn used to do lots and lots of takes when he would act in films and stuff. And here's Clint Eastwood, and he's shooting the rehearsal. He shoots the rehearsal, and he's done. Okay?
Yeah.
If you think you have another performance in, then you know, tell it to the press, because it's gone. And I think working with Eastwood for these actors was really a revelation, you know? It's like, I can get it the first time. I don't have to do four or five. Wow, maybe it works better this way. And both Tim Robbins and Sean Penn have talked about the influence of working with Eastwood and how quickly and efficiently he worked in terms of how it changed what they did.
So if you think if I worked with Eastwood, it wouldn't take me 3 days to write a 6,000-word column?
I'll
just bang it out in 20 minutes?
I don't think it takes you 3 days now, does it?
How dare you? All right, so we got Sean Penn.
It's that natural thing you've got going.
What athlete would you, comparing careers, Sean Penn's career to what athlete?
Let's see, difficult.
A lot of promise early.
Right.
A lot of hype.
Daryl.
Totally deliver in the middle of his career.
Mm-hmm.
Got a little weird.
Right.
Rallied back, and now is at the top of his game.
Hmm. Do you have somebody in mind?
I don't know. I think he's had a really unique career, atypical of how a Hollywood career arc usually goes.
Well, usually the things that he went through in the 80s would have shipwrecked a lot of careers, and it's hard to imagine an athlete having a career long enough for him to, you know, to him to, I almost might say Larry Brown.
Why? But if you're going to compare athletes and actors, you have to compress the actor's career and pretend that 30 years was really 15.
I see. The athlete's career, right, yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, that the stage from 82 to 86 was like the first 2 years of a career. And then
the obvious one would be Joe DiMaggio, right?
Oh, that's interesting. Joe D, though, he didn't have longevity.
Joe DiMaggio didn't have longevity?
He didn't have longevity with his baseball career. I think he only played for,
I guess in terms of his stature, you know, or something like that, you know. Or,
yeah.
How about Ted Williams? Hot-headed relationship with the press.
Yeah, Ted Williams is interesting.
Was, you know, but admired more
through.
As life went on, that kind of thing.
Do you think Sean Penn is on Ted Williams' level, though, talent-wise?
You know, I always I'm enough of a nerd that I always wanted him to do Shakespeare. I always thought he would have been, you know, I always thought he really was that good, you know, and we haven't necessarily seen just how good he is yet, so.
Yeah, because he picks weird movies for the most part.
He's attracted by interesting material, you know. He's not going to do junk or stuff that he perceives of as being junk.
With all due respect to Damon, he's not going to do the trilogy of the Bourne movies. He's just not going to do it.
I guess not. I mean, I don't know for sure, but I guess not, no. He's very demanding, you know. He has high, you know, he likes certain things in material. He likes certain things in directors. I think maybe he's less, you know, intense about that than he was 10 or 15 years ago, but I don't know for sure. But if it produces performances like these, we're lucky folks.
The fourth guy in the category, a movie I just saw a couple weeks ago, finally.
Mm-hmm.
Richard Jenkins in The Visitor. And if you don't know who Richard Jenkins is, really one of the top six or seven that guys who have ever lived, because I didn't even know his name until I saw this movie. I just knew him as that guy. I think, you know, there's different types of that guys. Like,
yeah.
Joe Pantoliano was that guy, but by the mid-80s, you knew his name was Joe Pantoliano.
Joey Pants. Joey Pants, right.
And then you get to the level of that guy where it's like the warden from Shawshank, where
right.
you just see the guy and you're like, hey, it's the warden from Shawshank. You have no idea who his name is. He's in 24 right now.
Mm-hmm.
And he's the warden from Shawshank. Like, you just expect him to you know, basically shoot somebody or give somebody the Bible or whatever. He can't shake himself from being the warden. But then you get to that third level where you see a guy and you're like, I know that guy. That mm-hmm. guy's been in stuff. I like that guy. I can't even think of a single movie that guy's been in. And with Richard Jenkins, it's like, I know I've enjoyed that guy.
Sure.
Basically, it took me like 20 minutes to remember that he was, not to bring this whole podcast back to Eddie, but he was Whoopi Goldberg's assistant in Eddie.
Wow.
That's how I knew Richard Jenkins.
Eddie. That's amazing. Wow.
Yeah. Hey, Eddie is now underrated. But,
wow.
So anyway,
wow.
he plays this guy in The Visitor. Really, really good performance. Underrated movie. I really liked it.
Well, if you saw the trailer, and maybe maybe people did it and didn't see the movie, you feel like you get it, you know? You feel like it's, oh, I got it. It's, you know, old guy comes out of his shell thanks to the influence. But it's that third act, that romance, that really charms you, that I think
right.
takes the movie to another level, you know? And the interesting thing about that performance is you see it gets the Best Actor nomination, you assume, oh, there must be some huge dramatic scene. There must be some, like, just aria that this guy lifts off on, and it's one of the, you know, and pieces of scenery are being chewed and all that stuff goes on. There's a little bit of that at the immigration place, but not much. That's not why he's there. He's there just because he's so solid. He's just, he takes you on this journey that you really like, and he is totally that guy. Like, I thought he was great in Burn After Reading as the soulful owner of the health club where Frances McDormand worked.
Right.
Who couldn't get her to be interested in him. So
I had a spirited email argument with the greatest living screenwriter on the planet, William Goldman, not to drop names, but
I'm sorry. Yeah.
He's a big sports fan.
Yes,
but
he is.
He put
you
that
wrote a book with Mike Lupica. Is he going to write
did.
A book with you?
What? No, but he wrote one of my favorite books ever called Wait Till Next Year. It's,
sure.
It's every time I get an email from him, it's the most exciting moment of my day.
I don't blame you. Not only is he a great screenwriter, he's a great thinker about the movies.
Well, he told me about this Jenkins thing, you know, like 2 months ago. He was like, this guy's going to get nominated. So I finally saw it, and I agree that he was great. But at the same time, this is the type of movie that De Niro or Pacino should be making, or the type of role that they should be playing at this point in their careers, like this understated role that they would have knocked out of the park 25 years ago, and now either they don't give a crap about acting anymore, or they've lost that talent, or whatever, they would just never take a chance on a role like this. So Goldman said those guys would just never, at this point in those careers, they just wouldn't be able to play that part, and I just got depressed. Like, really, it's fallen that far for De Niro and Pacino that they couldn't play the guy from The Visitor?
I think it's a question of economics, you know. You can't make that movie with Al Pacino or Robert De Niro in it.
Okay, but how much money do those guys need?
Well,
here's a part that could get them an Oscar and give them, like, this last leg of their career that right now they don't have.
Now, here's the other thing, though, you have to consider. If they're in that movie, a lot of the charm of that movie goes out the window.
Well, that was my next question.
Because you know who those guys are. It's like you were saying before. You always know who the star is. You bear in mind. That's Al Pacino, you know. Of course they're interested in hanging out with him. He's Al Pacino. That movie works because it looks like they took the guy from the cubicle four cubicles down from you in accounts payable, and they put him in a movie.
That's what I was going to ask you. First of all, I think Pacino, there's no way at this point of his career, because he became the son of a woman guy 15 years ago, and that's just who he is.
Okay, I'm not going to disagree with that.
I don't think he can act as a subtle kind of, you know, just capturing all the little nuances of a character anymore. He's just too over the top. It's gone. De Niro, on the other hand, I still feel like it's lurking inside there somewhere. I still feel like potentially, maybe, possibly, he could have played that part.
What's the last role he played that's a little like that? Would you go back to Stanley and Iris, maybe, with Jane Fonda?
You know, I'd probably go back to Mad Dog and Glory.
Okay.
Remember that? Which
yeah.
It wasn't a terrible movie, but he played kind of a nerdy guy,
right,
afraid of conflict.
But so much of these movies is about, like, how you root for these guys as they go in. And you see Richard Jenkins and this movie, and everybody in the theater goes, we have to pull for this guy.
Right.
This guy needs everything we can do for him.
And, well, that was my next question is, can you reach a point as an actor where you're just completely pigeonholed?
I think what people would say is it takes a tremendous amount of work and effort to not be. You have to work really, really hard for that not to happen. It can be done, but it takes a lot of effort, and the tide of the industry pulls you away from it. Like, you really, no one is going to say, I'm going to help you find a tiny movie that will pay you like 10 cents on the dollar. You know, you have to swim against the tide of everything to pick that project and to create that kind of characterization for yourself, you know. What you're really asking is for them to create the movie equivalent of the Bruce Springsteen career, where you go now, over the last 10 or so years, where you go from the acoustic private, you know, albums like Tom Joad or things like that to the big, you know, halftime show type things. The bifurcated career like that. That's really hard as a movie actor to do, I think.
It made me think how similar how similar acting is to playing basketball. In that sometimes there are roles that are right for certain people, and it doesn't mean that they were the best actor or that they had the most talent.
Right.
It was just the right person. And as you said, The Visitor works because Richard Jenkins is that guy. He could have been anybody, and you start rooting for him.
Yep.
And at this point, I have too much history with De Niro or Pacino to kind of make that leap with those guys. Now, you could use the same thing like with the Spurs. Kobe Bryant is a better player than Manu Ginobili. Manu Ginobili is better for the Spurs.
Yep.
I think Kobe screws them up. So, in a way, there's a lot of similarities. It's about how you relate to the other people in the movie, the history that you bring, what your goals are. Are you pigeonholed and playing a certain way?
And the only thing that's different in terms of acting is you can do all those things that you talked about. You know, you can play those roles. The thing you can't do is wipe from the audience's memory the 30 years they have of you playing characters.
Right.
You can't reach in and do that Men in Black thing and take that memory chip out. And so you have to confront that somehow. And that's really the story of Eastwood's career. I don't think you've seen Gran Torino, right? But that's what the Gran Torino performance is. The Gran Torino performance is based on the fact that you know what a Clint Eastwood performance is. And he's going to give it to you. And the rest of it doesn't matter. He's going to give you Clint Eastwood, and you're going to enjoy it.
Did you think he should have been nominated?
No.
Pete, the reports are mixed.
I think these are five excellent candidates right here.
Well, I like the first four, and actually I think, you know, historically, if you're looking at some of the greatest best actor categories ever, this is right up there, or at least for the last 25 years.
I would say the top one that I can remember is 1990? This is the one I always think of. Morgan Freeman for Driving Miss Daisy, Tom Cruise for Born on the 4th of July, Daniel Day-Lewis for My Left Foot. That, I think, is the most competitive best actor category of my experience. But this one's really strong.
I'm going to go online as we're talking. But defend the Brad Pitt performance for me, because in my opinion, it is the Luke Wennington, Luke Longley, Bill Wennington of the 96 Bulls.
Maybe they should have been cloned. Maybe they should have been like a little factory of, like, you know.
Baluke Wennington. In my opinion, it is that of this best actor category. I just thought he wasn't very good. He did nothing for me. He played basically Brad Pitt with aging makeup on.
I'm not sure what you would have had him do that's different from what he did. You know, I think that was, and this was discussed a fair amount. I know you were not a big fan of Benjamin Button, if I recall correctly. What was the movie that you watched with the sports gal and you were so bored that you began acting out committing suicide during the course of the movie?
Pretending to hang myself?
Yeah, slitting your wrists and stuff. She wrote about this. You didn't.
Yeah, you're right. I can't remember, unfortunately.
I thought that was a wonderful testament to your relationship. I love that image of you making her laugh in a boring movie. you know, that's just, I think that's what every boy wants, is a woman who will laugh at him while
Yes.
While he's dying of boredom in a movie. And when you wrote about Benjamin Button that way, I thought, oh, I bet Bill was doing that in that movie, too.
And then,
I liked it more than you did, I think. But I don't know what else Brad was supposed to do. I think he was supposed to be acted upon as opposed to instigating the action. So,
but did he act? Where was the acting?
I think you believed the charming relationship with, now I'm blanking on her name.
Cate Blanchett?
Yeah, no, the other one.
Oh.
the Oscar winner.
I can't remember.
You're online. Save our careers for us.
I can't remember. Well, no, I'm busy looking at these best actor categories, and here is an amazing year.
All right.
1982.
Sure.
Ben Kingsley wins for Gandhi.
Yep.
The third best performance of that year somehow wins. Peter O'Toole, my favorite year. The fifth best performance. Jack Lemmon and Missing. I actually don't even remember that one. But
that was a pretty good movie.
Dustin Hoffman and Tootsie doesn't win. Paul Newman in The Verdict doesn't win. That's amazing.
You sure you have your years right?
I'm looking at Wikipedia. Come on, how's Wikipedia ever been wrong?
I think Dustin Hoffman wins for Tootsie. I think you have the wrong. I think you've modeled the years there.
No, but he no.
I think Dustin Hoffman won for Tootsie.
He did not.
Really?
Ben Kingsley won.
You sure about that? Really sure? You really?
I am.
All right. Okay.
Now look at this. 1979. Dustin Hoffman wins for Kramer versus Kramer. That's probably what you're thinking of.
No, Dustin Hoffman won twice, I think. But keep going.
Didn't Dustin Hoffman win for... I'm looking. No. All right, 1979. Dustin Hoffman, Kramer versus Kramer. Jack Lemmon in The China Syndrome. That's a bad one.
Okay.
Al Pacino in Injustice for All. Roy Scheider and All That Jazz.
I'm not out of order. You're out of order. This whole trial is out of order.
Roy Scheider and All That Jazz.
Boy, am I now.
Roy Scheider and All That Jazz and Peter Sellers and Being There. That's a power pack.
Yes, it is.
That's a good one.
If anybody has never seen that Peter Sellers movie... Unbelievable.
Right. So I thought those were the two best years of my lifetime. Although this one amazed me. So
I'm going to stand to be corrected. You're right. He did not win for Tootsie. He should have won for Tootsie.
I love that we're both Googling things as we do this podcast. people are in their cars going, really? Really? No research?
Well, William Goldman or anybody who knows these things is watching. They've already thrown the computer against the wall.
Yeah, they're done with us.
Moved on to This American Life.
This was an underrated one, though, and there were two terrible performances. I won't even mention them because the Nigel Hawthorne and Paul Newman that I don't know how they got nominated. But 1994, Tom Hanks wins for Forrest Gump.
Yep.
Morgan Freeman doesn't win for Shawshank.
Right.
John Travolta doesn't win for Pulp Fiction as Vincent Vega.
Right.
What's interesting about that, those were three of probably the most iconic performances of the last 20 years.
Yes.
When you just think of, like, what performances just jump out in your head? You think Red, you think Forrest, and you think Vincent Vega.
I know, amazing combo. But, you know, the thing you have to remember is they did for those actors what they were supposed to do. You know, I mean, Morgan Freeman was in the pantheon by then already. And not everyone feels about Shawshank the way you and your pals feel about Shawshank.
Oh, come on. Bite your tongue.
There are a number of people who feel it's a little too long and a little too much.
My God. Who are these people?
I'm just saying. But John Travolta had all the reward from that character he needed just from having played it. Like, he didn't need the Oscar. He got his life back.
Right.
You know, and he knew it, and everybody knew it. And so the nomination was a way to acknowledge it. I think that would be the idea. But your point is well taken. That's three tall trees in that are still standing.
And I think this year ranks up there. The one as I was looking through this list, the one that just kills me, and I feel the same way about Oscar voting as I do about MVPs in baseball and basketball. I just can't handle it. I just look back. I'm like, oh my God, we're crazy. 1998, Roberto Benigni wins for Life Is Beautiful as Guido Orifice.
Yes.
Edward Norton, American History X, does not win.
I don't have a problem with that.
Oh, what?
I'm not in the Edward Norton fan club as an actor as much as perhaps you are. So
not for that movie, though.
I will sleep well tonight. You know, remember what he was doing on that movie. Remember he was, you know, and I don't remember the details, and nor will I Google them while we talk. There was a lot of jumping in the edit room. There was a lot of different versions of that movie. That doesn't play so well to the Academy. You know, that's not seen as being an especially cool thing to do. And so there were a bunch of stories about that at the time. I'm not saying that was the reason why things fell the way they did, but that could have been a factor.
Fair point. All I know is...
However, I mean, him in that... What was that movie that he really made his reputation in, the one...
Primal Fear?
Yeah. I mean, that was some fine, fine work for Mr. Norton.
See, I thought he was amazing in American History X. And he basically played two characters in the same movie because there's such a transformation. But when you throw in the fact that he may have used illegal PEDs to put on the 25 pounds and then dunked two-hand reverse with a basketball in the pivotal helter-skelter basketball scene, pushes it over the top for me. When do you think the big PED scandal with Hollywood actors is going to happen?
When do you think we have to go back? If I can't enjoy actors on performance-enhancing drugs, then we're all going to have to stop watching 1941.
That's a good point. That's a good point. I think it would be funny if there was a big scandal and everybody now worried about, you know, how we remember these guys' histories because... You know, Jake
Gyllenhaal.
You
can come up with quite a list of movies that existed entirely because of performance-enhancing drugs.
Oh, how about every action movie from the 80s?
Or, you know, it's like, I used to say you wouldn't be able to listen to a Rolling Stones album if you felt that way. But, yeah you could say the same things about movies.
I feel like we have to talk about this, even though I really don't want to. And if you don't want to, just tell me. What do you feel about this whole PEDs, baseball player's legacy, like just the outrage that's going on right now?
You know, I think the one thing I'd like to hear more about is the psychology of the player who took them. You know, I feel like envy and resentment more than the desire to achieve is the thing that made people take those things. You know, it's like, not that I'm going to get better, but those three guys over there are taking them. I have to. I think that's what drives Olympic athletes to do all that stuff. The feeling that somebody else is doing it. The feeling that there's an inherent unfairness because lesser talents are doing better than they should because I have to do it just to keep up.
Right.
You know, and so, you know, you could make the argument that the funny thing about steroids that we refer to as cheating is usually referred to something that allows you to exert less effort and get the same result. And part of what steroids do is it allow you to exert greater effort to get a greater result, you know, allow you to work out more, allow you to, like, not have to, you know. So I feel like we'll get a better snapshot of why this all happened when we get a better understanding of what the psychology of these guys was when they took it. I have to take it. You know, those other guys are taking it. It's nobody seems to care, you know.
That's why I've had such trouble trying to figure out where I stand on this whole thing, because I said this on Brian Kenny's radio show last night. We can't put ourselves in the mindset of those guys because you don't know what it's like to be a professional athlete competing at the highest level, hitting your 32 homers, and then seeing some other dude that you know is cheating.
Yeah.
Hitting 55 and then getting paid for it.
And no authority stepping in. And particularly in the case, you know, in the case of like a McGuire. You know, people rushing to the barricades to cheer, you know.
Deifying him.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, I mean, if you feel like not only is there no governing authority, but the governing authority is, I mean, who is telling me not to do this, you know?
Right.
I mean, I remember actually writing a Mark McGuire testimony remix at one point. Like what Mark McGuire should have said before the committee he testified for. And it was like, did I put things in my body that, you know, that kids shouldn't do? There are a million things I do to my body that kids shouldn't do. You know, I can't tell you enough things that I do to my body that kids shouldn't do. You know why I do it? Because everyone wants me to. Because the fans want me to, and my teammates want me to, and the team wants me to, and the league wants me to. I'm an entertainer. I'm paid to get out there and entertain. Of course I do things your kids shouldn't do. But yeah. You don't have time enough to hear all the things I do. You don't want to know about them.
This sounds like a movie scene. What movie scene am I thinking of? Scarface? The say hello to the bad guy?
The end of Scarface, that big pile on the table there. Does that come with a free cannon towel?
Do you think that was real cocaine?
Is that like a box of Dash, you know, back when we used powdered detergent?
You know, obviously I try to watch Scarface every 9 months just to, stay in touch with one of the great movies of the 80s.
Uh-huh.
I've never totally reconciled Tony Montana's weird pseudo-sexual attraction with his sister.
With his sister, yeah.
Who had, like, that poodle haircut. Mary Elizabeth Mastrantonio, was that
yes,
her name?
Yes, exactly.
Never quite reconciled that.
That was
a little creepy.
That was Brian De Palma, pouring more. Did you see Black Dahlia, by the way? Brian De Palma's most recent film.
Was that, did that have Hilary Swank in it?
It did have Hilary Swank in it.
Yeah, that's
Mia
why I didn't
Kirshner,
see it.
Outstanding in it.
Really? See,
she was great.
I can't do Hilary Swank in any sort of a role where she's sexy.
Okay.
I need her to either be playing a dude or playing like the Peach Pit waitress who has the kid at home who's falling for Steve Sanders. Like that's what I need from her.
Okay. All right.
Even when she played like they did the Dangerous Minds ripoff with her, I couldn't even handle that.
Hmm.
Yeah.
She's a lovely woman. She may yet be able to, and a 2-time Oscar winner. She may be able to convince you otherwise.
See, that was a good role for her. The boxing movie. I like that. The sexy roles for her just don't
okay.
do it for me.
But, okay.
Wait, we got to go back to the Oscars.
Go right ahead.
So, quick predictions.
Yes.
Best picture.
Slumdog.
You think it wins?
Oh, absolutely. If it doesn't win, I'll do your laundry for a day.
Wow, you're that convinced.
Oh, yeah. What
I'm surprised by that.
What beats it?
Let's look at the odds.
Why don't
you give your runner-up while I Google the odds right now?
I don't think anyone else has taken it in a fair fight yet. I think in the Guild Awards, and I think it's your strong favorite. Now there are always surprises. I was there when Jack Nicholson read the word crash instead of the words Brokeback Mountain. So I heard the scream. So we could yet hear the scream again.
That ranked up there with, if you made a top 10 biggest Oscar tragedies of my lifetime, I think that's right up there.
I am not going to deny that one bit.
Brokeback Mountain was a great movie.
Yes, it was. And will remain one, too.
Yeah. And now I think it's gained a level of poignancy because of what happened to Heath Ledger.
I think that's true also.
Something kind of off-putting about, other than the obvious reasons it's off-putting, but when you're flicking channels and you come across Brokeback and you see Heath Ledger and you just think like, man, what a waste.
It's very strong. I mean, it's just very strong. It's just, those three were really good in it. So.
Okay, so we have Slumdog Millionaire, courtesy of one of these legal offshore betting. Slumdog Millionaire, over-under for total Oscars won. 4.5.
Okay.
What do you think?
I'm going to tell you, I don't really track the numbers that get won so much, but that seems like a pretty good number. Because you figure director, you figure picture, you figure perhaps cinematography, it's won that before. Hmm. Maybe it gets a song nomination. But I will admit, I'm not so I haven't parsed art direction and things like that to that degree.
Slumdog is -300 to win the Oscar, which means you have to bet $300 to win 100.
I think those are accurate odds to the degree that I understand odds.
Basically, Benjamin Button is 3-1.
Wow.
If that wins Best Picture, I give up.
It would be surprising. It wouldn't be unprecedented, but it would be surprising.
Best Actor, the greatest category, at least in 15 years. Sean Penn, even.
Right.
Mickey Rourke, -150.
Right.
Which means you have to bet 150 to win 100. So he actually has the best odds. Langella's +700.
Mm-hmm.
Richard Jenkins, +1200. Brad Pitt, +1,000.
I'm putting it on Richard Jenkins.
That's
I'm pushing
Richard,
it all in the middle of the table on Richard Jenkins. I'm like Jim Fassel on Richard Jenkins.
It's not inconceivable that he could win, though, right?
It's not. It's never inconceivable. That's the crazy thing. It's not inconceivable. The craziest thing that could happen this year, crazier things have happened before.
Best actress, Kate Winslet.
She gets it, I think. Close with Streep.
-166.
It's because Streep competes with one more actress than Winslet does.
Well, she's, you bet 166, you win 100 on Winslet.
All right, then.
Meryl Streep, 100 to win 350.
Okay.
So, and then Anne Hathaway, 100 to win 160. So she has the second best odds.
Well, that's, you know, I thought she was fantastic in that movie. That was one of my favorite movies of the year, Rachel Getting Married. But that was a terrific movie.
I haven't seen it yet, but my wife went and said that she was fantastic. So since we're married, I'm going to go with her verdict. Angelina Jolie is +1,000.
It's a good performance.
Maybe
it's just not going to win.
It didn't do much for me, and neither did that movie, to be honest. Wow. Heath Ledger, The Dark Knight, best supporting actor. No, it's on the board, -2,000. So you bet $2,000 to win 100.
Wow.
Now, I might suggest maybe you parlay Heath Ledger with Sean Penn and Slumdog Millionaire. That might get you close to even odds.
Yeah. I mean, the risk you're taking is with Sean there, yeah, because that's even Steven, that one.
Best supporting actress.
This is a total, I mean, people think they know who will win this, and this is the category that tends to produce more surprises than any other. Just ask Lauren Bacall or Vanessa Redgrave.
Penelope Cruz, -175. Marissa Tomei, +350. Viola Davis, +275.
Mm-hmm.
I think Marissa Tomei wins that. I think you show your boobies, that increases your chances.
She's already won. She already has won. Jack
so
Powell,
she wins again.
Her name.
Best director, Danny Boyle, -600. Nobody else is even 4-1. Oh, yeah. David Fincher's 4-1. So it looks like Danny Boyle.
I think.
You know what's interesting about that? So basically, Slumdog's going to win. He's going to win best director, but they didn't have an actor nominated. So none of the actors were worthy of even getting like a best supporting actress.
I know. Well, look at it the other way. Doubt has 4 acting nominations, and the director isn't nominated. I don't know if that's ever happened.
And Bruce Springsteen was not nominated for...
I know. Can you believe that?
So
Amazing, huh? It's okay, because apparently they would have only... I don't know if they would have let him play the whole song, so maybe it works out for everybody. I don't know.
How do the Oscars say, you know, it's a bad idea if Bruce Springsteen performs? I would think they would have rigged that the same way David Stern rigged co-MVPs for Shaq and Kobe on Sunday.
I can't hear what you're saying, yeah. No, I don't know why it didn't get nominated, but it didn't, so...
All right,
maybe the movie came out late. Maybe it wasn't seen as a, I don't know. Or maybe the Academy doesn't like that kind of music. But, you know, whether or not it got nominated, whether or not he would have performed are two different questions. But for whatever reason, it didn't get chosen, even though I think it's one of the highlights of that record.
Your personal favorite movie of the year?
Rachel Getting Married. It's so good on family. It's so, you know, all these other movies do really big emotions, big things, big, you know, big sweeping things happen to people. Rachel Getting Married really reminds you of, like, how families actually work. Under stress, you know, in a big situation with a marriage, with a wedding about to go on, and a wild card sister and stuff. But there's just so much in it that's smart about what it's actually like to be in a family or, you know, and that I was really impressed with it. Jonathan Demme. Doing it again.
He, in the all underrated discussion, is in the mix.
Absolutely. He wasn't such a nice guy, if he didn't have such a reputation for being a mensch, maybe people would give him more credit. But he's that, I gather. And, you know, he's still the guy responsible for the last movie to do the Holy Cross, as I like to call it. Best picture, best director, best actor, best actress.
The Holy Cross.
The Holy Cross.
I would have gone with the Four Corners.
Okay, well. I'm going to go with the Holy Cross.
favorite performance?
Favorite performance?
Yeah. Male or female?
Bill Irwin and Rachel Getting Married. Didn't get nominated.
What did he play?
Played the dad. I thought he was great.
Most overrated performance?
Oh, no.
Oh, you got to interview these people.
Most overrated performance?
Right, we're at like the 50-minute mark of the podcast. Nobody's listening at this point. Anyway.
Most overrated performance? Probably something for Revolutionary Road. I didn't like that movie very much.
Yeah, I didn't like it either. Maybe it's because I actually like my wife, but I have trouble with these Marriage is Awful and It's the Root of All Evil movies.
You can't do Suburban Enemy like that after Desperate Housewives, after Mad Men, you know.
Well, that's the thing. Mad Men explored that whole topic on a much better, more complex level. So then to see it condensed to 2 hours, I just wasn't.
Right.
With that said,
I got Christina Hendricks to talk to me, by the way, on the red carpet. That was a big moment for me.
Did you keep your eyes in
contact
with her eyes?
I did. Of course I did. Of course I did. She was.
Wow.
I have terrible news. She's super nice also.
I would have turned into like somebody that, you know, after you get the broken neck and you have that broken neck brace where you can't move your head, that's what my body posture would have been like. So I didn't look down. Just, I'm staring at your eyes. I'm not looking down. I'm looking at you.
She's very nice.
You've heard my basic instinct idea, right?
No. I guess I have. Who do you want in it? Or you want? I'm the only heterosexual male who saw Basic Instinct 2, by the way.
No, I'd like to join you on that list. Although I didn't see it in the theater. Now I have two
in
ideas.
In the theater, that's right. The only heterosexual male in a theater who saw Basic Instinct 2.
I did these ideas on Dave Damashek's podcast, so technically I'm not double dipping. But first of all, I'd offer $20 million for Basic Instinct 3. And I think the salary itself would become such a big deal in the community that it would create the buzz you want for the movie. And then by the time it actually comes out, maybe you don't even give totally the nude scene. But it's like that. Remember, what was Heaven's Prisoners with Terry Hatcher?
Heaven's Prisoners. That's
or
a
Halle
Bill
Berry.
Gimano movie.
Or Halle Berry.
Where the reels of film were left out in the rain by mistake, I remember.
Yeah. Or Halle Berry and Swordfish.
Yeah.
There have been movies that made money simply because people wanted to see the nude scene.
Well, I'm not. I can't speak to your concept for Basic Instinct 3 in terms of who the actress is. But here's the thing that I've always thought they should do if they did a Basic Instinct 3. You know how you make money on that movie?
How?
Pay-per-view. You never put it in the theaters. You just sell it pay-per-view like it's a, like it's a Ultimate Fighting Championship or something. You know why? Because everyone wants to see it from the, and nobody wants to see it with anybody.
You don't want
10 guys around to watch, but you probably want to watch it, you know, in the privacy of your own home.
You know, I think back to senior year in college when Basic Instinct came out and I had to sit in a theater with probably 27 other single guys.
Awkward.
Yeah. Now I wouldn't have to do that. I'd just wait
Awkward.
For until.
And you'd make all your money your first day. All your money back the first day.
I like pay-per-view. It's kind of like what the American Pie franchise did. Where they don't even put the movies in the theater anymore. They just go right to video and pay-per-view. So that's one idea for her. I think that would work. The other one, a little more controversial. It's a Hand That Rocks the Cradle type movie.
All right.
But in the movie, she smothers the children of whatever family she's being the nanny for. She smothers them with her breasts. And it's called Crib Death. But it's called Crib Double 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 D Death. So you got like 8 D's in the title. Basically, you're telling people right away what it's about, and it's basically Hand That Rocks the Cradle meets Bosomy Breasts.
That sounds like a vivid film, or perhaps an Andy Sedaris film.
It's a movie that would come on Cinemax at 11:30, and people are watching. So that's my destiny for her.
I think at the end of the day, comedy, because this would only have to be comic. This is like a Lost Russ Meyer screenplay. This, you know, Kitten the TV Dodd would have had to have played this.
Well, Hand That Rocks the Cradle was a thriller, but now it's a comedy.
The funniest thing about Hand That Rocks the Cradle is there's more movie in the first 90 seconds of Hand That Rocks the Cradle than in the entire oeuvre of, like, John Cassavetes. Like, more things happen in the first 90 seconds of Hand That Rocks the Cradle than entire Wikipedia IMDb listings.
There's a lot of holes in that movie. I still want to know how somebody dies just by having the glass in a garden house crash down on them. The odds of actually dying from that, I think, are low.
Well, you know, we have to move on, though, right? I mean, they die like before the right. They die before you see who cast the movie, right? They're still putting up the opening credits, and like people are dying, and there's a baby, and there's somebody else, and
right.
All
you
the
know,
rest of it.
I think you and I should be on the committee for. There should be a committee that goes back over the movies of from like 1982 to 1991. And reclassifies any movie that was allegedly thriller, action, whatever, as comedy.
As comedy?
Yeah, and we decide. Like Breakfast Club, was Breakfast Club always a comedy? Breakfast Club now is a comedy.
Yeah, but it was a, you know.
It's kind of a dramedy.
Yes, it was. It was.
Now it's a comedy.
Yes.
Now you watch that movie.
It was the days and nights of Molly Dodd with lots of kids in it.
Right, right. All right, quickly. Sunday, you're working the Oscars.
Yes. I'm not entirely sure what I'm doing, but I'll be there.
Red
and
carpet
it's funny
show?
Because you're in the same position with your book right now that a lot of Oscar nominees are.
What do you mean?
A lot of Oscar nominees right now are getting calls from people they haven't heard from in a long time. And you know why? It's because those people want to be mentioned in the speech. Hmm. This happens a fair amount. Like even the night before the show, executives, agents, people will call likely winners just to say hi, just in the hopes that their name will get in the speech. And since you're finishing your book, I'll bet people are calling you right now hoping you'll mention them in the acknowledgments.
And nobody cares. wait a second. You brought up speeches.
Yes.
Explain to me the phenomenon of people who are professional actors and actresses who are trained professionals at channeling their emotions and expressing them exactly how they want to express them in front of large crews of people.
Right.
Who then win an award, get on stage, and act like you know, they're in some sort of cheerleading competition or something, like a 16-year-old. What happens in that moment that makes them lose everything that their career is constructed on?
What happens when trained athletes score touchdowns, you know? What happens when guys score Stanley Cup winning goals, you know, it's, I think you flash back to when you were 6 or 7 or 8 and you imagined a moment like that, just like we imagine hitting the shot that, you know, that wins the Bill Russell MVP award.
Yeah, but Jordan hit his famous last shot in the 98 finals.
Jordan is, as we know, hard cases make bad law. Jordan's a unique individual, you
okay.
know. The rest of us lose it. And, you know, these are people who deal with in the realm of human emotion, you know, so they're alive to emotions
yeah.
in their lives. They're not, their job isn't to be controlled like athletes are. Their job is to be alert to stuff. And I'm sure until it happens to you, you don't really know what it feels like. I think it's like somebody coming down. Remember that old, Globetrotter trick, you know, where they throw the bucket and the bucket was filled with confetti, right?
Yep.
I think it's like having a bucket of happiness thrown at you. It's like somebody ran down the aisle and threw the bucket at you, and now you have to, you know, now you have to pull together and speak. You have to thank people or you'll never forgive yourself. But all these other little, you know, synapses are firing. And that's why we watch, is because
yes.
these poised people lose it. And that's what's so great about it.
So your comparison would be more like John Stockton hitting the shot in the 97 playoffs that sent the Jazz to the finals when we didn't even know he had emotion, and he's just jumping up and down like a 12-year-old.
If only Kate Winslet wears pants that short on Sunday, we'll all
right.
be happy.
Is there one person you want? Like, what's your dream interview on Sunday? Mickey?
Well, I think Mickey and Jerry together – Mickey and Jerry Lewis together are going to, you know, that's like cold fusion. I think if you put those two together, like crazy, crazy stuff could happen.
So your goal
like those,
on Sunday.
It'd be like those old tapes you can buy, you know, of Dean and Jerry talking.
So your goal on Sunday is to somehow seize the moment if they are within maybe 20 feet of each other.
Well, we'll see. I'm not sure what my assignment will be. I'm not sure I'll even have a microphone in my hand, but that's the thing I want to see.
What do you mean? What else would you be doing? Like fetching coffee?
You know, I might just be watching for highlights or things like that. So, but that's the thing that's going to be so interesting. It's like, what happens if those two get together? And also, you know, like if Kate Winslet wins. Let's face it, Kate Winslet is a great actress. It'd be cool if she won. So,
I'm kind of fascinated by the whole thing where she married the director, but she still talks about Leo's her best friend. her best friend is like one of the five best looking guys on the planet and richest and like the exact type of guy you wouldn't want your wife to be best friends with?
If there's only one other person, well, it's a little comforting to know that your wife's best friend is dating the woman on the cover of the Sports Illustrated swimsuit issue.
That might be fine, but if my wife was an actress and she became famous because of this movie she made with this guy who's now an icon, and she's like, yeah, Leo and I are going to do a press junket, and yeah, hey, where were you last night? Oh, Leo and I, we went down and got dinner, and then we watched a movie, we just crashed.
You know, yeah, but they didn't meet like the kids in Twilight, okay? They didn't meet in their little high school cafeteria with trays. I'm Kate, I'm Sam. What do you want to do? I want to be a director. I want to be an actress.
Yeah.
You know, they met after she was Kate freaking Winslet, you know?
Okay.
So he's, you know, you better know what the, you better know what the drill is, you know?
I don't care. He's a man, and any man is jealous the entire time.
Well, it's Kate Winslet. I couldn't blame him if he did. She's great. She's great on the carpet. She's great at these shows. She wears amazing dresses. She looks like a real person and not a stick figure.
Right.
I'm in the fan club.
I'm in the fan club as well because she is the type of person that is not going to dip below 100 pounds. She's true to herself. I did think she, you know, maybe overdid it in Titanic a little bit from the, you know, she may have been a little too big in that movie. But other than that, I think.
She had a couple of kids, you know, she talked about, you know.
She's a woman.
You know the sketches in that? Well, it's too nerdy. The sketches in that movie are based on the Nastasha Kinski pictures that were taken for Rolling Stone back in the day.
Really?
Yeah, if you match them up, you'll see they're very similar.
I think it's interesting that if you looked at the mid-90s, maybe like 97, 98, and again, this is where acting reminds me a little bit of sports, where you think, all right, Gwyneth Paltrow is going to be the superstar here.
Yeah.
Kate Winslet was the girl in Titanic. She's English, probably not going to make it. Not Gwyneth Paltrow. I don't know what happened to her. Like, she's like a vegan. She's doing shows in the Travel Channel. She talks with a British accent.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
What happened to her? Meanwhile, Kate Winslet now is the meal ticket.
I know. Well, I mean, you know, I remember interviewing Morgan Freeman when he was up for the Oscar for Driving Miss Daisy.
Yeah.
And he said, boy, I said, you must really want to win this or some version. And I said, well, it could be bad for your career. You know, it's like, you know, because, you know, your price goes up and you don't get the good roles and it changes the way people view you and stuff. You know, so Kate Winslet might not have been able to have her career if she was Oscar winning Kate Winslet. You know, it messes with your choices a little bit. So maybe that's why. But the thing you talk about is so true, particularly in music. We've talked about it all the time. You know, can you imagine like 10 years ago, Lil Wayne is still a star. And Lauryn Hill hasn't put out a record? What kind of odds would you get for that 10 years ago?
You just don't know what's going to happen to people when they get famous.
No, that's so true. She went to college. She went to Columbia.
Yeah.
She was an Ivy League student, you know, and something seems to have happened. You know?
It's like that snow globe you get with the fake Christmas setting where you can shake it and the snow comes down. That's basically what happens to people when they become famous.
You can't, yeah.
And it might end up where you shake it and everything's the same, or you might shake it and everything might be upside down.
Well, remember the great George Clooney line about this. He was interviewed by Newsweek, and Newsweek, I think, said to him, or maybe it was Entertainment Weekly, Matt Damon says that when you become, that you stop maturing when you become famous. And Clooney had a four-word answer. He said, that's true. Matt did.
I remember that. Yeah, Clooney's handled it the best, and I think John Hamm is right up there. I'm proud of John Hamm.
Yeah.
He stayed pretty true to himself, but it seems, we've talked about this before, it seems like the later it happens, the better chance you have.
And I do think that's true.
Even Harrison Ford happened late for him, right?
Pretty much so.
Clint Eastwood, same thing?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, Eastwood transformed the way people thought about him, you know?
Well, when they have movieprospectus.com, the spinoff of Baseball Prospectus and Football Prospectus, and they break down like the actor VORP and some sort of age range thing, I bet it'll come out like it's better to be famous when you're later.
I want to be the guy with the radar gun, pointing it at young actors and actresses as they
you
come
got
by.
It. All right, Chris Connolly, enjoy yourself on Sunday. Always a pleasure. Anything on ESPN coming up? Am I going to cry? Am I crying anytime soon?
I think you can still see a little Project Healing Waters piece that we did with the talented producer Dan Aruda about veterans who are and active duty soldiers who were disabled or wounded in the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, who are having fly fishing, finding fly fishing helps them out. So that's a pretty neat piece, and I think you can still find it on our website. So
cool. All right, we'll talk to you soon.
Take care.
Whoa.
Thank you for downloading the BS Report with Bill Simmons.
Too much fun.
Check out more podcasts at the iTunes Music Store or at Podcenter at ESPNRadio.com.
Peace out.